Before rock and roll, before pop, before everything, there was the blues, the music of struggle, triumph, and truth. Welcome to Talking Blues, where we honor the legends and tell the stories that shaped modern music. Here's your host, Matt Cooper.
Raised by his grandparents, Deshaun Jones spent his childhood riding out to rural churches in the 1970s. His granddad on guitar, young Deshaun on drums, barely big enough to reach the pedals. That's where it began. The blues condition felt, the beat used to survive it. From Tiki Fullwood to Questlove, Prince to Sunday Morning Gospel, his style was shaped by groove and soul. Now based in Hamilton, Deshaun supports blues artists with that same rhythm because he's lived it. Here's Deshaun Jones.
I reside in Hamilton now, but I've had family in Hamilton for over 40 years. But I was born and raised in Toronto. Yeah, but I've hopped around, lived in different places. But yeah, Hamilton and Toronto would be the main two cities in Ontario.
I was born and raised Don Valley Parkway and 401 area. Whereabouts were you in Toronto?
I was down at Queens Quay, like Harbourfront, and then Bathurst. I went to Central Tech High School. So, you know, near Honest Ed's down the street.
My dad.
So that was the old stomping grounds, you know, Oakland and Vaughan. So a lot of different areas in Toronto, but mainly along the Bathurst strip, Harbourfront, up all the way up to Young and Wellesley.
A great city to grow up in.
Back then it was. It's changed a lot.
It has. No, it has. And then another thing that we have in common is I was just on your Facebook profile, and well, you've been behind the mic in a number of different scenarios.
Yes. Yeah, I did. Had the pleasure of experiencing radio and getting some really great stories. But yeah, I did about 1 year. I was at CKLN 88.1 Ryerson Radio, and then had the opportunity from a gentleman who has now passed away a while back. Rest in peace, John. His name was Jim Leake. He gave me an opportunity to be a part of Trafalgar Broadcasting in Oakville, and it was a 24-hour faith-based Christian programming. Joy 1250 AM, it was called. Very powerful AM station. It was the sister station to AM 740, and which is a huge Zoomer, owned by Zoomer, Zoomer Media now. And they also had a community channel called CGMR 1320. And, but it was great. We had a youth program. So I did a 4 hour show that played what I call positive urban music. So it was hip hop, R&B, reggae, but it was all with a more positive message. No swearing or nothing like that. It was all about inspiration, you know, and giving an opportunity for the younger demographic or the youth generation to hear some more positive music or lyrics with the music that they would hear on a mainstream secular station, but without all the other connotation that would come with popular music.
Now, was that a scenario where they said, okay, Deshaun, we need to get to the youth, put together a programming style, or was it they said, here, we have this message, get this message out for us? How to tell us how that came about?
Well, Jim was always involved in being a voice for Black gospel music in Toronto. And me, I was an advocate for that growing up in my dad's church, playing drums and growing up playing with choirs in Toronto. And the radio show I had on, or I was a part of, was called Come Sunday. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning. It was really early. It was all about, you know, playing traditional and contemporary Black gospel music. And, you know, always keeping in touch with Jim because I was doing promotions for artists at the time. You know, trying to get artists, Black gospel artists on radio, you know, and his program was open to playing, even though it was predominantly contemporary Christian, which is, you know, more or less country or pop rock styles. And knowing that there wasn't a lot of representation for Black gospel music. So he was always open. He was a great ambassador for us to open up those doors. And he came to me one day and he said, "Hey, we want to have a program that targets towards youth." He knew I was involved in doing concerts. And he heard my show or the show I was with, and he heard how we were. And he said, "Hey, would you be interested in doing a show?" It's 4 hours, 4 hour programming. So I had to break it all up and break it up every hour and come up with different styles of show, topics to talk about within a 4 hour period. The show was called Praise Joint. So we spelt it PRAYZJOYNT. So it was a little play on the words, and needless to say, I got some flack from the Christian community because the last word was joint. And so I was like, "You guys don't understand. That means club, or, you know, it's not what you smoke." So yeah, it was fun. But it was a great experience. And, you know, I give all that to Jim. Unfortunately, he's, you know, not with us right now anymore, but he was a great advocate and ambassador for gospel music in Canada. And he gave me that opportunity. So that's how I got into radio. Did that for like, I think I did it for like four or five years. And it was good. We had a DJ. It was really interactive. We had a lot of kids. It was a lot of people calling in. It was really good. And being on a powerful AM station, I didn't realize how AM was so powerful, because it would bounce off of the water. And we would get calls and emails from people that would listen to us in the early days of internet, because we used to stream online. And we get calls from Las Vegas. We get emails from Las Vegas in the States. I was like, that's insane. I didn't realize that it could travel so far once the signal bounces off the water. So it was, radio is fun. Radio has always been important. It's always been an important medium. I think it always will be. It's the interaction. It's different than just streaming, you know. Where streaming, I find, is new radio. But yeah, the interaction with the audience and the DJ and the personality and the artist is definitely important. So podcasts, I feel, are the new radio, are the real good radio too, because we were looking at the early stages of that, of trying to incorporate video with our radio show. But it was at the very early stages. We never got it off the ground. So it's nice. I appreciate your programs like yourself.
Well, I was in the radio business in the 90s. I started at the Fan 1430 in Toronto. And as a Torontonian, you might remember that was just after Music of Your Life. Just when the Jays were kicking in around 91, 92. He was off to Timmins shortly after that, Q92, and 750 CKGB, Today's Hot New Country, and Q92, Sudbury's Best Rock as well. And you know what? Radio played a very important part. This is kind of pre-internet here. A very important part to small towns. I mean, this was the, you know, a connection for people that didn't necessarily have outside information. And so I felt it played a tremendous part in establishing and maintaining community atmosphere in small towns. And after the internet, not so much. And now I'm back, Deshaun. I'm back, and I have a platform.
You have a great voice for it, that's for sure.
What's that? Thank you.
You have a great voice for it.
Kind of you to say, my man. You know what? It's great to be here. It's great to be chatting with artists and musicians and like yourself. I'm looking forward to this platform, because no one can stop us, you know? And so that's the great thing about it. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the time when drums came into your life, and, you know, just before you got to the point where you started playing at church. But back it up a little bit and tell me about when drums started to come onto the scene for you, started to become aware of.
I grew up with my grandparents, and him being a preacher. So we traveled a lot, and he was a musician himself. So he played B3 organ He had a Les Paul, the black guitar, like B.B. King. And I think the first time I saw, I got the, I mean, seeing drums at churches all the time and you hear them playing, but he used to travel to a lot of churches in the country, back countries and older roots, older rural areas. And this is like early 70s. I was born 71. So first time I saw him play, because there was no drummer in the church at the time we were visiting, and he doesn't really know how to play, but he did it anyway. You know, it kind of, I was sitting there, I was like 8 years old, and I was just looking, and I guess he saw me look, was looking, and then he stopped and told me to come on. And he's, and I was like, I was afraid, of course. And he's like, you know, cause he wanted to go play the guitar. Okay. So I went and he just showed me simple little, you know, 2/4 time, just keep it going. And it was off the races from there. And, you know, so it's seeing him play and him playing with him at the time, with the first time in his little country church. And I just kept on going and kept on going. And then seeing, then going, visiting a lot of the US churches and then watching and seeing some of the young kids there play, and they were like amazing. So that kind of continued to spark the interest of, I want to be that good. You know, it just kept on going and falling in love with the percussion. So they tried me on piano, didn't like it. And then realizing down the road, piano is a percussion instrument, you know, even though it's strings, it has, it's more percussion. Tried guitar, even though I love guitar players, it just wasn't my thing. And, but I saw how the drums kind of kept control of everything and kept the foundation of the song. So that really caught me and just fell in love with it from there.
So your grandfather's put the sticks in your hand. He's put you behind the set and he said, keep rhythm for me while we entertain the folks, when we connect with the folks. So you're doing that, you're getting the groove, you're getting good at it. Tell me about the time when you started to notice, you said you started to notice other kids in some of the different cities that were playing real well. How about other, say, you know, high profile drummers? When did they start to come on the scene? Gene Krupa, Ringo Starr, Keith Moon, John Bonham. Who came on the scene for you that inspired you?
Well, I'm going to say, well, I remember when I first heard some like reggae with Sly and Robbie, Sly Dunbar and Robbie Shakespeare from Bob Marley's drummer. And then when I heard Bernard Purdy play, and Bernard is like one of the most sampled drummers in the world.
Purdy Shuffle.
I was just like, wow. And then I saw Buddy Rich. I saw him on, I think it was a talk show. I was young. I was like, probably Johnny Carson or something. And Buddy Rich was on there. And I just saw him play. I was like, fuck, this is the style of jazz and the way he was just doing. And then Sammy Davis Jr. used to, you know, people didn't realize that he used to play drums too. So when I saw those guys in my early days, I was like, oh, well, okay, that introduced a different style of playing where, you know, I was used to gospel drummers, where they did a lot of reggae. So that's where the reggae influence came in, and watching like people like Bob Marley's drummers. So then when Clyde Stubblefield from James Brown, you know, hearing the funky drummer, hearing the control. And then when I stumbled on Dennis Chambers, my life changed. Dennis was 19 years old playing for Parliament Funkadelic. And when I knew he was 19 playing with those type of grooves, that I was like, okay, I need to be a funk drummer, a pocket drummer, as they used to call it. And I needed, and with mixed with Clyde Stubblefield and those guys staying in the pocket. I just love the pocket. And it was just, that was it. And it was just, and then that evolved into like hip hop, and then hip hop drummers, you know, then you look at, Questlove from the Roots as a hip hop drummer. He was like a metronome, and it was really great to see that. And it just evolved from there. And then when I then falling in love with Prince, when I heard Prince and then knowing that he played so many different instruments and seeing, and then actually hearing how he played and his orchestration, that was just those type of drummers evolved me into wanting to learn different styles and appreciating different styles and the discipline it takes to learn jazz. It's not easy, the true jazz drumming and then funk drumming. You know, reggae, there's different styles of reggae drumming too, when you have those, it's like the technical aspects of jazz, and then you get into the blues and then, you know, the shuffle, and then how that helps with even country music. It's just like, okay, they're all blended, but you got to put, you know, you put your own swing into it, or you put your own, then you put your own flavor, a style in it, and attitude as a drummer. You got to put your own vibe on it. So those are some of the influences I've had, you know, growing up, that came to my mind. Oh, Terry Lynn Carrington. She was one of them too. She used to play for Arsenio Hall, and fell in love with her as a drummer, and other than Sheila E. As a percussionist. But Terry Lynn Carrington was a dangerous drummer to me. So she's still playing. She's still active to this day.
Some great names there, and some great memories. I remember seeing a documentary on Bernard Purdy, and how he applied the Purdy shuffle for yep. Donald Fagen as they were putting together, I believe it was Asia, the Asia album in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Donald very being particular on the sound that he wanted. And Bernard King said, well, here, I'll give you some of this and give some of that. How's that? Yeah, that's what we want. It was the Purdy shuffle. And, you know, and so, but that worked out fine. Yeah. The other thing you mentioned was, as soon as you said Bob Marley, the way he hit, the guy hits the hi-hats and the timpani is just, it's said, it puts shivers down the spine, you know?
It was very dramatic. I just knew how to just get it, because you didn't expect it. And it would just come in, and it would be a sharp tone, but it's just direct.
And a little bit of a lilt, just offbeat, just a little bit. Oh, you know, I have it on repeat a lot of the times, because I need more and more of it. So let's back it up a little bit. Now you're really starting to get the groove. You're starting to see some heroes out there. You're getting inspiration. You say, hey, these guys are doing, I could do this. Now it's really starting to open up. You're seeing the different styles. Tell me about the time where you got into the technical aspects of it. You started to see, look at the different styles, the rudiments, the hours in the woodshed, getting the grooves down. Tell me about your dedication that goes into making it look so effortless.
Well, I mean, it's outside of, I guess, destroying my grandmother's pots with wood sticks growing up. On weekends, usually before like Friday, Saturday before the church service, my grandfather would was my adopted father too, so you'll hear me go back and forth and say dad, grandfather, it's the same person. He would go down to do church maintenance, you know, fix the church bus or clean up the church or have a meeting. So I would go after my chores, and my grandmother, you know, she wouldn't let me out of the house until I got my chores done. So I would beg and plead to go with him. And that way, because I know the drum kit was there. So, you know, pull away the backdrop that would be on the covering it from the dust. And he'd be there for hours. So I would just play, and he would just let me go. So it was knowing that I still needed to be tight. Like, I wanted that tight sound. I wanted to, you know, work on my paradiddles or my fills. You know, hearing how those other drummers, and not just the ones that were on TV or on record, it's the ones I would say, you know, I see at other churches. You know, it was not really a competition thing, but it was, you wanted to be, it was taught by within the church. If you're playing for the choir or you're playing in the music department, you have to play with excellence. It didn't matter what you did, but you had to do it with excellence. So or else you don't play. that was just it. You just don't play. And I wanted to play, and I knew drums were it for me. And I just would practice, you know, and practice. And he just kept on every time he would go down, saying he's going down to go fix on church stuff or go work. I would ask, can I go? You know, and that was because I had access to the full kit, you know, in my house. I had access to a makeshift little thing, but to actually, you know, in my mind, I would pretend that the whole church was full, you know, and I'm playing with the whole choir. So I'm hearing it in my head and working on my, my fills, working on how I would intro the song, working on how I would end the song. How, if I ever got a solo, what would I do? You know, so it was all those type of things you play in my head, but then still thinking, okay, I got to work on the basics. Even then, I didn't have a book, didn't have a teacher. Everything was done by ear, but it was, we had one senior musician that would always tell me that. He goes, practice these things, you know, the different, you know, stick movements, different fills, just practice that, keep it steady, know about timing, and, you know when to come in, and don't steal the show necessarily, but you got to play a solid part by being the foundation. So it stuck to my head, and that's, I just wanted to be good. You know, I wanted to be really good.
It sounds like you couldn't have been out playing with your buddies, but, grandma made you do your chores first, taught you some discipline. And I think that went into the makings of a professional musician. I mean, you went down there and you did it. You had the ambition and you put the work in. And, you know, a lot of folks appreciate what a musician can do. Very few that aren't musicians understand really what goes into the finished product. And it's really the same mastery that's required to perfect any skill. And it's, the musicians, we call it the woodshed. You know, get out there and practice it until you know it so well you can do it backwards. It's not a matter of what to play next. It's a matter of how hard you're going to hit it. You know it so well. So good for you.
I appreciate that.
One thing I wanted to touch on with radio, and because I so rarely get to chat with fellow radio folks, I finished my radio career with two souvenirs. One was encroaching deafness in my left ear because I always had my headphones on my left ear and keep my right ear open so I would hear the studio and I wouldn't hear my own voice too much. You know, I wouldn't get that affected sound. So I'm almost deaf in my left ear. The other is the dead air dream. Do you ever have the dead air dream, Deshaun?
I have a dream. Well, I've had a nightmare because it's happened to me before.
Right? There's dead air, and I can't find the CD, and I can't find the commercial, and for no matter, I can't, because my instructor nailed into my head, no dead air.
Yep,
so, exactly. Yeah, I have the dead air dream and the bad hearing. And if you Google dead air dream radio guy, you'll see it. It's a common thing. Those are my souvenirs.
Yeah, I've had a nightmare, my reoccurring nightmare of a dead air scenario that happened at the radio station, and unfortunately, it was funny. I put a song on a mini, back then I had a mini disc, and I was the only one doing an air on air, so I didn't have my DJ, didn't have my co-hosts or anybody. So I put on a mini disc that had, you know, supposed to have at least a good 20 minutes of programming on it, you know, with ads and everything pre-programmed. So then I did put that in. And I went to go use the washroom. Didn't bring my key with me. And the main door locks. So I went out because I went to use the washroom, but I went to go grab a coffee. And then it locked. So I'm, you know, I have it on my phone. I'm listening, you know, because I want to make. And then I'm like in the line at Timmy's or Tim Hortons for coffee, whoever, if this is going anywhere else in the world. And then it just went silent. And I thought I lost my connection. And then I look and I'm like, I see the clock still going. I'm like, oh my God. I just left my coffee, ran back to the station, and the door was locked, looking for my key. And I was just freaking out. And I'm like, okay, calling whoever I can call. Luckily, there was an engineer that was working in the back doing some soldering. And then I said, you got to run in the station and put on a commercial, something, and open the door for me. So it was a good, I mean, it feels like forever, but it was only like maybe 5 minutes. But in radio time, that's like 5 hours. And I know I was going to get a phone call from the program director the next day. And I did. So, you know, that's a reoccurring nightmare. I was like, oh, my heart was just going nuts. But it was, you know, it's an experience.
Oh, and you'll keep that with you. But what a helpless feeling, you know, when you're responsible for that. When I was in rock radio, I was the DJ. So I was the host and the jock. I would take a stopwatch, and I smoked cigarettes in those days. So you would look for a song like Neil Young's Down by the River was about 9 minutes. That was a smoke break. Yeah. So you take your stopwatch, run outside the building, and try and get back within that 9 minutes. Those were the days. But here we are in 2025, and you are using your expertise to help folks on their way up get a leg into the music industry. And you're halfway across the world doing that right now. Tell us what you're up to now, and give us an idea of what you're doing, and we want to talk about that.
Yeah, well, currently, as we're talking, I'm in the beautiful country of Malta. I'm working on a theater production. I'm supporting as a co-executive producer with event planning and sponsorship for a theater production. And next month, or on my way, I'm going to be going to Croatia for the European Blues Union's annual Blues Marketplace Expo. And I'm promoting Canadian and U.S. and even one from Italy, blues artists that are unable to attend a conference such as this because of the cost of traveling. And I have a program called Band Push that I started back in 2007. And it's the goal was to connect bands and brands to come together. And I call it jumping on the bandwagon to go into the same direction, which was being presented at this conference or conference music conferences and to delegates, executives, festivals, media outlets, just building the connection. For business development, and which helps with the audience development, which helps with their artist development. So it all trickles down. So that's been what I've been doing. A lot of it, they call it now, is like record label services for artists that aren't signed to a label, but still need those same practices or services, because those are things that are needed for any type of artist development. So it's been great. I love doing it. And helping artists in various capacities as a consultant, being involved in, you know, different facets of the music industry has helped me understand the mechanics of music business and how to connect the dots at any level. Because I always tell a lot of artists, what you see major labels do, they do it, and you should be doing the exact same thing, but at just at the level that you're at. They have more human resources. They have more financial resources and connections, but you could still take their campaigns if you're being observant and bring it down to you, you know, your community or your budget or your reach. If you're only in your own city, okay, then you can produce your own little tour and get sponsors. And there's community radio. There's community television. There's local newspapers. You're still knowing the essence of marketing or the mechanics of music by reaching your audience. You just need to know where they are, who they are, and how to get to them. And then after that is just work ethic, just putting in the work. So that's what I've been bouncing around doing it. There was this time where I had to put it down for a little bit, and I was doing more event marketing for a company for about 10 years. And that helped me learn a lot about the live event industry, and where now it's more, I'm doing a lot of booking, a lot of tour development and managing for some blues artists, looking at getting into helping and working with a lot more gospel artists into Canada, because that's it's an underdeveloped genre, and it always has been for a long time. And it's, other than being a passion of mine, and turning it into more of a professional passion, and still allowing the opportunity for independent artists to get professional representation without having to worry about giving up their life, the farm, as they say. You know, it's more or less finding out what they need and then what they want, because there's always needs and wants in everything, and being, and then having, give, providing with some type of direction. So that's what we call it, band push, because, you know, an acronym, promote until something happens. Be persistent until something happens. Performance until something happens. You know, in the the other side of it was that where that acronym came from, in the gospel world, it was prayer until something happens, you know, to push. So it's all positive. Either way, it's all positive. So I call it band push, and that the goal is to push bands and artists in the right direction.
There's something very refreshing about what you're doing there. For those old enough like us to know what the record business was like 50, 60 years ago, it was find a goat, sign him up, work him till he can't work anymore, and then take all his royalties. You know, it's really changed. The entire, and you would know better than I, the entire complexion of the record industry has changed. And to know that we're now more focused on supporting the artist and helping them grow. And yeah, we're going to get compensated along the way, but it's not about ripping them off and going and finding the next sucker. It's about helping our fellow musician and artist grow. And so I feel great about that. I feel great about what we're doing here, because we have a platform to showcase, and we don't have to listen to anybody else tell us, well, that's not commercially viable. Well, that's, you know, that's not your business. This is what we like to do, right? So this is the kind of platform that we should bring artists on. You know, I want to hear about their struggles, about their passions, where they've come from, what they're doing, and promote what they're doing, where they're going, what they're playing.
Huge value for what you do, and artists need to. I mean, there's platforms. There's so many platforms out there, and but it's not just about getting an artist to say, I'm going to do it and talk and give the whole performance of an interview. It's having a genuine, authentic conversation between two people that have a passion and a love for music, and not just a surface passion. It's been rooted from pretty much from birth. and you can tell when you talk to someone else. There's always consistent smiling, because I know I've been watching your face and I'm watching mine on the screen, and we're both been smiling, talking about this stuff. And that's refreshing in itself.
In 1985, you know, it was jeans, leather jacket, long hair. And since I've been loving you, Led Zeppelin on the boombox on repeat, I was digging the blues. I didn't know it was blues to show at that point.
Wow.
Yeah, it wasn't until I dug in and went down the tracks to find out where it came from. And that's when I really fell in love with the whole genre, the whole history, the cry of oppression, where that came from. And the older I get, I have such a distaste for oppression of any kind, be it people, animals. I've gone vegetarian. I can't sport fish anymore. And so the plight of blues musicians really touches me. And so I'm glad to make these connections.
Yeah, man, blues, I always say blues and gospel are relatives. You know, they both came from the plantation. One went to the pulpit, the other one went to the pub. You know,
But they both came from the field, pretty much, right?
Yeah, they both came from the field. They both came from the plantation. They both talk about struggles. They both have the wailing. They both have the way that they can. They were both communication songs, like music. That's how they used to communicate. It's just one talked about the sorrows, and then how they dealt with those sorrows, the trials and the tribulations, and then the other one directed that there's trials and tribulations they talk about. But they channeled it, and instead they gave it back as a worship, where a faith, you know, where the blues artist took it and drowned it in alcohol, drugs, cigarettes, and women, you know, and violence, because it got into, and that was the nature of it, where, you know, but they still, that's why this is the genre styles of their performance is very similar. You know, and which birthed other genres, pretty much you name it, other than classical. Well, yeah, other than classical music. But even other than classical music, it's birthed, you know, rock, country, bluegrass, you know, because it came down from the Appalachian Mountains. And you got jazz, reggae. Well, I mean, and again, it's using instruments that came from Africa, like the banjo, and just the call and response. A lot of that was there. You know, that's where a lot of it came from. So I look at it as the true root. You know, they have roots music, that's a true roots in folk music is gospel and blues.
That's a lot of what we're going to explore on our program, you know, turn of the century kind of stuff, like Charlie Patton, you know, his influences, Son House.
Yep.
And from today, you've got Keith Richards, influenced by Robert Johnson via Muddy Waters.
Yep.
Right. It wasn't a direct influence, but it did by osmosis. It made it through.
A lot of it. It's really good to see how it's affected different genres and different styles of playing musicians to, you know, even look at how it's affected electronic music. It's all there. And if you just connect the dots long enough, you'll find out where it comes from.
And I personally think it's fascinating to look back to see where it's come from. I think that's where the real heritage lies. And I'm a musician. I don't play professionally, but I love to play, and that's my expression of the blues. You know, I play the bass. I'll put on a drum track and I'll do, you know, eighth notes for half an hour, and that's how I get my blues off. You know,
nice.
So I love it, but it's an expression. It's my way of doing it, and so I love hanging with like-minded individuals. So it's good to have you. It's good to have you in the fold, my man.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. I look forward to hearing from you again. If you would share your journeys with us, we'd love to hear about your escapades and the people that you're promoting and helping to get to the next level. We want to be part of that as well. So
definitely, as much as I can, I make myself available as much as you'll have me. Well, definitely, you know, keep in touch. I'm going to be on your Facebook like crazy. I'll be posting. I'll be posting a lot of the artists I'm currently working with, through Bandpush, through TaylorMade Management, and through Mango Tree Music. You know, there's going to be a lot. You know, there, and I want to share because I'm excited to share. You know, these artists, to connect artists to an audience. You know, it's always been that thing for me, even through my radio days. It's sharing new music, or, you know, it's great to get a phone call. I'm sure you remember these days. It's great to get a phone call from somebody calls in and says, "Who was that artist? They sound amazing." You know, those are good feelings when you're able to connect an artist to a new audience.
Yeah, no, I agree. And somebody says, "Boy, I never knew that Keith Richards learned to play from Muddy Waters." And I use that analogy over and over again because I'm a big Keith Richards fan, but it's something that might be a second hat to you and I, but it might be a mystery to new blues fans. So I guess it's our kind of responsibility to make sure everybody knows where it came from.
Definitely. We're curators, but I think that people like ourselves we're custodians of the creators, you know, and custodians of the genres that have influenced us to share to some people that are, let's say, our age or younger, to say, did you know this? Yeah, I bet you didn't know this. You know, it's like a dad, it's like a parent showing their kid, "Oh yeah, you like, you know, this group, but did you know that that song is actually from this person?" And they're like, "What? Didn't know that." So it's like that, you know, and it feels good. It's nice to educate people that didn't know, and to see the depth of how music can travel over generations. You know, it's amazing.
Custodian of the blues. Boy, I can wrap my head around that.
There you go.
That's a wrap on Talking Blues. If the blues speaks to you, hit subscribe, share the show, and let's keep the tradition alive. Until next time, keep it raw, keep it real.